Chapter 7 begins this way. In the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham. So let's get out. You don't remember all the dates, I don't presume. It seems that Uzziah died in 736 BC. And chapter 6 was about that. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw, we did it last week, in the temple, etc. Remember that? The vision. So, Uzziah died and his son Jotham, who was regent during the 6 years of his confinement or whatever, was only king for 2 years. So, in the days of Ahaz, son of Jotham, Ahaz, as a young boy, really, became king in 734 BC. Okay, located again. The northern kingdom collapsed under the Assyrian invasion in 721. So where still the northern kingdom is intact, that's Israel, is intact still in 734, when Ahaz down in Jerusalem becomes king. And Isaiah is in Jerusalem, and that's where we're located. So in the days of Ahaz, son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram. Aram, Aramaic, Aram is an ancient name for Syria. So we're talking about Damascus and that area, you know where that is. And King Pekah, the son of Ramaliah of Israel, the northern kingdom, went up to attack Jerusalem. New king, boy, possibility of intervention. Why? We're going to find out. They could not mount an attack against Jerusalem. They besieged the city, but didn't work. When the house of David heard that Aram had allied itself with Ephraim, another word for the northern kingdom, Israel, the heart of Ahaz and the heart of the people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. Then Yahweh said to Isaiah, "Go out to meet Ahaz, you and your son Shear Jasub, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field." Not exactly sure where all that was because I haven't done archaeology, but it's somewhere in Jerusalem. "Say to him, take heed, be quiet, do not fear, do not let your heart be faint. Because these two smouldering stumps of firebrands, because of the fierce anger," don't worry because of the two stumps of firebrands, "because of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram, the son of Remaliah. Because Aram, Syria, with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah, has plotted evil against you, saying, 'Let's go up against Judah and cut off Jerusalem and conquer it for ourselves,'" and here's the point, "'and make the son of Tabeel king in it.'" They're organizing a coup because they want the king of Jerusalem or Judah to be in alliance with them. Why am I stressing this? Because Isaiah does, the text does, but it's another, and I'm now about to explain it all to you, but it's another example of the absolute need to read the Bible in context. Because everything that's going to come now in chapter 7, 8 and 9 was all from Isaiah at this time. So this is the background. This is why he said it. Pull it out of its context and you can't make any sense of it. Do you get me? It's got to be contextualized in this situation. So let's do my best to explain that to you if it needs a little bit more explanation. As noted in the introduction, we did this on the first day and it's in the book, the reign of King Tiglath-Pileser III, and there is dates, so it's during this period that we're talking about, was a period of Assyrian expansion. At first, King Rezin of Syria had no choice but to submit to Assyria as a vassal state, meaning paying a massive tribute, "Leave us alone, we're on your side, we won't fight against you, and here's some money." So they say, that'll do, because they didn't want to fight. No one wants to fight unless they have to. However, King Rezin of Syria, Aram, took the opportunity of Assyria's concentration on its eastern borders. Syria is west of Assyria, which is Iraq. it's concentration on Urartu and Media to break away. So there was troubles on the other border, so the army went over there. You can think of Hitler trying to get into the Moscow and then, you know, all that stuff. So they're going over that side. To organise an anti-Assyrian alliance with King Pekah of Israel, and they joined together. In 734, the Assyrian army, however, made a sweep, victorious sweep, all along the Mediterranean coast. So they went along the top, Lebanon, and then straight down to conquering the Philistine cities and reaching the borders of Egypt. This is all historical stuff. Syria and Israel are now vulnerable from the east and the west. Can you picture the geography? From the Mediterranean side and from the Iraqi side. And King Rezin of Syria and King Pekah of Israel brought pressure to bear on Jotham to join the alliance. And you can find the history of that in the second book of Kings. When Jotham died the same year, 734 BC, and was succeeded by his young son Ahaz, Syria and Israel decided to invade Judah to depose Ahaz and set up a puppet regime, so they besieged the city. This was the situation that provoked Isaiah's intervention. His message was that it was Yahweh's will. Was he right? Was he wrong? I'll discuss this with you a bit later, because you can't presume he's always right in picking up the inspiration. Do you get me? We talked about it earlier. God is inspiring Ahaz in his prayer, but Isaiah. But that doesn't mean Isaiah always gets it absolutely on the knock, on the button. He can, but he did. It was his understanding of the inspiration that it was Yahweh's will that Judah remain neutral and not put its trust in Yahweh, neither joining the anti-Assyrian alliance nor reaching out to Assyria and saying, "You come in and we'll be on your side against the northern kingdoms." They're the two opinions that are going around Jerusalem, and the politicians are turning up in their limousines and having big discussions in caucus about what to do. The siege had to be lifted because in 733-732, Assyria attacked and conquered Syria, and they took Dor, Galilee and Gilead from Israel. So Israel, all the northern, and now I'll read what it says here, Israel saved itself by a coup which replaced Pekah, who was one of the king of the alliance, with another man called Hoshea, who favoured accommodation with Assyria. It would have been suicidal for Judah to align itself with the ill-fated alliance. So actually, Isaiah, the least you can say is that he was politically astute and said, "This is hopeless. Don't join them because they can't cope. They can't fight with Assyria. It's not going to work." And within a year, it proved itself it didn't work. So he was pretty cluey, but he's claiming more. He's claiming that it was inspired by God, his intervention. Ahaz decided, however, to put his trust in Assyria. He didn't. He was wise enough not to side with Syria and Israel, but he did call in Assyria and submit to the overlordship of Assyria, which involved paying tribute and opening Judah up to Assyrian imperialist influence. So he didn't follow Isaiah. The people that made the political decisions half followed him and half didn't. A negative result of Ahaz accepting to be a vassal state of Assyria was that his son Hezekiah, in his well-intentioned attempt, we haven't come to him yet, but to initiate religious reforms in Judah, felt compelled to break off the treaty with Assyria. When Ahaz sided with them, they brought in their statues, they brought in their gods, you know what I mean? They brought in their imperial religious dominant stuff, and so the country of Judah was compromised spiritually and religiously and nationally. So when Hezekiah revolted against that, he had to get rid of Assyria, which posed a major problem. Had they not sided with Assyria, maybe the problem wouldn't have arisen. This fateful decision led to the devastation of Judah in 701, which we saw in chapter 1 of this Isaiah, at the hands of Sargon's successor, Sennacherib. Sennacherib claims to have destroyed 46 fortified strongholds and made 200,000 homeless, probably exaggerating for his own honour, but you never know. Had Judah remained neutral in 732, this may not have eventuated. So Isaiah's advice may well have been totally astute. But that's a judgment of history that I can't make. But there'd be reasons for thinking that Isaiah was truly in touch with God and speaking from that inspiration quite accurately. Okay, we'll finish this and then I'll move on. Ahaz's decision to link Judah's cause with that of Assyria opened Judah and Jerusalem up to Assyrian influence, and by relying on Assyria and not on Yahweh, Ahaz led Judah down a path of religious compromise. Judah lost its way. Isaiah's call was for Judah to put its trust in Yahweh. It is this trust that gives them their identity and meaning as a people. Failure to trust Yahweh can lead only to disintegration. So that's locating the first six verses. Perhaps I've been a bit long on that, but just to put you in that historical setting so that we can read the rest of 7, 8 and 9 and help, hopefully, make some sense of it for us. You ready? Let's move. Now I'll move more fast. Thus, verse 7, thus says the Lord Yahweh. It, that is, the plot against them by Syria and Aram, shall not stand, it shall not come to pass. If you do not stand firm in faith, you shall not stand at all. And one other tiny little lesson in Hebrew, just so that you can hear it, you can see the English letters there, and underneath is the Hebrew. Hebrew would actually have to read from right to left, but I've put the Hebrew words under the English just for you. Just listen to it. Im lo ta'aminu, ki lo te'amenu. Ti'aminu, te'amenu. You can hear the rhyme, the rhythm, the poetry, the memorable phrase coming to you in Hebrew. You don't get it in English, but you do get it. Im lo ta'aminu, ki lo te'amenu. I think you'd remember that. If you heard that, if you don't stand in faith, you won't stand at all. The whole meaning of their country, the whole meaning of who they are as a people, they have to hold on to that. If they lose that, they've lost everything. They might as well not be. Again, Yahweh spoke to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign of Yahweh your God. Let it be deep as Sheol. You hear people keep saying, I probably said it myself years ago before I knew better, Sheol. Do you ever hear people say that when they say Sheol? The trouble is the E here is one of those little Sheol. Sheol. Can you hear the E there? But the sound is on the O. Doesn't matter, but it does matter. Let it be as deep as Sheol, that is the underworld, Hades in the Greek sense, or as high as heaven. But Ahaz says, I will not ask, I will not put Yahweh to the test. That could be virtuous. It could be avoiding the issue. I don't know which it is. But the next bit is the more important bit. Yahweh himself, says Isaiah, will give you a sign. And this is the sign. Look, the young woman, Hebrew Alma, which means a maiden, an unmarried woman, someone who's just at the stage of being able to have sexual relations and be a mother. So we're talking about 12, 13, are we? You know what I mean? Whatever it is in that culture and depending on development and all that kind of thing. So we're talking about a young maiden, an Alma. That's the Hebrew. Pregnant and carrying a son. So she's just pregnant now, young girl, but pregnant now, 734, 733, something like that, will name this child when it's born, 6 months' time, 5 months' time, depends how long she's pregnant, in other words, very soon, they'll name him Emmanuel. They're that confident. God is with us, and I'm going to call my little child, my first little child, I'm going to call him Emmanuel. God is with us. You with me? He shall eat curds and honey by the time he knows enough to reject what is wrong and choose what is good. time to reject what is wrong and choose what is good, I presume it's something like 75, is it? Because I'm 72 and I'm still not sure. So I presume it's going to come soon. No, it means the age of reason, seven, whatever, I don't know, what, you know, but old enough now to make up their own mind, so a boy, not a baby. For before the child knows enough to reject what is wrong and choose the good, the land of the two kings whom you dread will be deserted. It's Isaiah's way of saying, this is God's sign. Look at, now we'll come back to this. Any woman, it could be, or it could be talking about a particular one, but in general, any girl who's just pregnant now and got a, they're going to call their child Emmanuel, and by the time that child's a few years old, the north will be collapsing, so don't join it. You get it? It's going to be all very imminent. The alliance Ahaz fears will soon collapse, and the final collapse came in 721. That's 12 years, or 11 years, or whatever, after this point he's making. So he could see a very imminent collapse of the north, and he was right to see it. Young mothers now expecting will be so confident that they'll name their children Emmanuel. And within a few years, Syria and Israel will be deserted. Why I'm stressing that is, go to the Greek, the Septuagint, that is the Greek translation of the Bible in the 2nd century BC. So nothing to do with Christianity here. But in the Septuagint, the word Alma was translated as Parthenos. Parthenos means virgin, not maiden. Maiden can be a virgin, but in fact this maiden is actually pregnant, so this maiden isn't a virgin, but it can mean virgin. Hence, the New Testament always is like this. The New Testament, of course, is dealing with the Greek version of the Old Testament almost universally. Some of the books look at the Hebrew, but nearly always you can presume what they, because they're writing in Greek and they're written in the Greek world, so they're talking from the Septuagint, not from the Hebrew. So when Matthew, you know the scene, talks about Mary and pregnant with Jesus and quotes this text, a virgin will bear a child and they will call him Emmanuel. You can find that in Matthew 1:23. So what's it doing? What's he doing? He's seeing in Jesus and Mary and the miracle of Jesus and he is the Son of God and all that. And I don't intend to go into that topic with you today. You might like me to, but I won't because I've got too much to do here and I've done that in other places. So you've got that scene. So Matthew, as he's always doing, invites his Jewish brothers and sisters and aunties and uncles and people who've rejected Jesus to go back to their scriptures and see it. And so he quotes this text. It's a little bit iffy because actually the text in the original, it doesn't have virgin, it has Alma. But that doesn't make it wrong. He's trying to make as many links as he can between Jesus and their Jewish background. Hence that quote. He goes on. Yahweh will bring on you and on your people and on your ancestral house such days as have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah. The break after the death of Solomon, when Rehoboam and Jeroboam kind of fought and Israel broke away and said, well, you can have your ditch, you can keep, we're not interested in Judah and your deserts. We're going to go independent of the dominance of David and Solomon, you know, and all that Solomon did to get the wealth of the country, according to the Bible, then story anyhow. And he had the people forced labour, his own people, and they divided them into different groups and they had to do a certain amount of hard work, all that. Like, they weren't happy with him at all. And when he died, they just said, well, we're not going to be run from Jerusalem anymore. We're going to run our own show. So they broke away. And that's what that's referring to. It's going to be just Yahweh will bring on you and your people and all your ancestral house. Such days have not come since the day when you lost the northern kingdom, Israel. What's he going to bring upon you? He's going to bring upon you the king of Assyria. It's going to be just as bad as it was all those years, centuries ago. The text goes on, continuing the threat. You can read it for yourself. I can't give you every verse or we'd be here forever. Then chapter 8, verse 1 to 4 reads, Isaiah had intercourse with a prophet. Oh, it doesn't read. This is with a prophetess. You'll read it in there. Who is the prophetess? Is it his wife? Is it a prophetess means a member of the temple group, because the prophets were often a little school, almost like a religious order, you could say. They're a group of people who probably had scribes among them, and they kind of... So prophecy wasn't just an individual thing necessarily, this school. And there's a woman in there who was a white witch. No, I don't know what, but someone who had very, like a lot of women do, intuition at such a high degree, and people would go to her for advice and she would speak out of prayer, all that. So Isaiah has intercourse with her. I hope it was his wife, but we don't know, because in the Old Testament they're a bit freer about all this. You know, they see God is working through strange ways, and you probably know about Judah having intercourse with a woman and then he finds out that it's actually his daughter-in-law, and because you can read the story if you'd like to read these kind of things. Don't give the Bible to your teenage children or they'll get all kinds of ideas. So Judah goes out to a prostitute, really, but the prostitute is his daughter-in-law who's tricking him. And so when he has it, he hasn't got any money to pay, and she demands his personal staff, like only he had, and his signet ring, as a guarantee that he would come back and pay her. When he came back to pay her, couldn't find her anywhere. Then his daughter-in-law is hauled up before him, independent of everything, because she has committed adultery, and he's about to condemn her, and she produces the staff and the ring. So Judah felt a little bit embarrassed, caught in a rather difficult situation, and she's praised, by the way, in the Bible for that, because that was the way that the inheritance went on. Had she not done that, the dynasty would have stopped. So it was her way of ensuring the continuance of the dynasty. So big stuff. But anyhow, there we are. He has a child, and he called, or she has the child, and called Maher Shalal Hashbaz. There's a name. I mean, some of the names they're called these days are nowhere near as sensible as this one. So if they're coming up with one and they want a biblical name, hit them with that one. Quick spoils, hurry, plunder. Like it's just four words. Boom, 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 boom. Quick spoils, hurry, plunder. It's a symbolic name. It is a further sign of the imminent collapse of Syria and Israel. Just a little metaphor thing. Poor little kid had to spend the rest of his night. Isaiah continuing, Yahweh spoke to me again, because this people has refused the waters of Shiloah. You know, Siloam, the waters of Shiloah, that's the little stream that runs outside Jerusalem and feeds the city. It's a little... Now, because this people refused the waters of Shiloah, their own water supply that flow gently and rejoices in Rezin, the son of Ramaliah, therefore the Lord is bringing up against it the mighty flood waters of the river. The river is the Euphrates, Assyria. The king of Assyria and all his glory, it will rise above all its channels, lovely, and overflow all its banks. It'll sweep on into Judah as a flood, and pouring over, it will reach up to the neck, and its outspread wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. Land where God dwells is going to be swamped entirely by this powerful. Take counsel together, but it shall be brought to naught, all your advice and all your... Speak a word, it will not stand, for God is with us. God is with us, so that's both punishment, of course, in their understanding, and grace, and I'm not exactly sure how to interpret that passage entirely, but you can get the general drift of it. I was going to read Psalm 46 for you. It's worth reading to see how the Psalms link in, but I won't because of time. Let's continue. And the blue is the text of Isaiah. And here we have, on the right, some texts. Yahweh spoke thus to me while his hand was strong upon me. Felt the presence of God. And warned me not to walk in the way of this people, saying, do not call conspiracy all that this people call conspiracy. Do not fear what it fears or be in dread. So you've got two political movements. One is talking about siding with Israel and Syria. The other group are saying, no, let's get Assyria in. And they're saying this is a conspiracy. The people, they're fighting each other over which way to go politically. And they're not happy with Isaiah because he's saying go neither way. So there's all this, he's being badly spoken of and all the rest of it. Don't be in dread. Yahweh of hosts, him you shall regard as holy. Let him be your fear, let him be your dread. Don't take notice of anyone. Just listen to what I'm telling you, God is saying to Isaiah. Hold your ground, stand your ground. He, that's Yahweh, and this is important because it's quoted in the New Testament often enough, he will become a sanctuary, a holy place, a stone one strikes against. For both houses of Israel, brackets, this is my bit, those favouring alliance with Assyria and those favouring alliance with Syria and Israel, he will become a rock one stumbles over, a trap and a snare for the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many of them shall stumble, they shall fall and be broken, they'll be snared and taken. So God will be an obstacle in between these two groups that they'll struggle over. So let's go to the New Testament, where Peter uses the same imagery here. Even if you do suffer, says Peter, for doing what is right, as Isaiah suffered for doing what is right, you are blessed. Don't fear what they fear. Don't be intimidated. In your hearts, sanctify, sanctuary, holy, Christ as Lord. Stay in the holy place. Stay in your communion with Jesus. Stay in your communion with God. And don't let the persecution around you shake you from that truth. Romans chapter 9, verse 33. As it is written, see, I am laying in Zion a stone that will make people stumble, a rock that will make them fall. So he sees Christianity like that, really. Jesus as a kind of stumbling block for people, if they reject, of course. And here's Luke. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces. It will crush anyone on whom it falls. I guess all I'm doing is, the imagery there is taken from this text of Isaiah. And the point of the imagery, though I haven't time to go into it in detail now, is to hold on to your faith, hold on to the words that God is speaking to you, remain faithful, and don't be afraid of the powers that are in the early church trying to wipe you out. An interesting little development here in chapter 8. Bind up the testimony, seal the teaching among my disciples. Seems to be Isaiah, who's getting out on the streets and talking, is getting nowhere. No one's taking, they're not taking notice of him. So he decides to go to the Rheinberger Center and close the doors and just speak to a group of people who are very lovely and accommodating and so on. You know, so he's in other words, he's keeping on prophesying, but to a group of people who are listening. The word has to keep going even, but out there it's being rejected. Isaiah's word has been met by a hardness of heart. We saw that in chapter earlier. Because they refuse to listen, Isaiah retires from public life to address a circle of trusted friends, to build a community that will carry on the truth. I will wait for Yahweh, who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. That's the leaders of the community. I will hope in him. See, I and the children whom Yahweh has given me. Children could be the disciples, or it could be a reference here to the symbolic names of the two children we've heard about so far in chapter 7, verse 3. Shea Yashub and the other child, Maher Shalal Hashbaz, these children here. Probably it's the disciples, but I don't know. See, I and the children whom Yahweh has given me are signs and portents in Israel from Yahweh of hosts, who dwells on Mount Zion. And that text is actually quoted in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 13. Isaiah is quoted all over the New Testament, and that's why I guess I'm alerting you to that. Chapter 8, verse 19. Now, if people say to you, which they were saying, consult the ghosts and familiar spirits that chirp and mutter. So, you don't know what to do, you're all scared, what's going to happen? So you rush along and get your palm read. I got my palm read once by a friend. I was going to have seven children. And I was thinking, my God, I've left it a bit late. And some woman has been saved from a fate worse than death. Anyhow, but or tarot cards, or, you know, there's all these things you can do, or you can read the stars, you know, to know what's going to happen to you today, because you're Aries or you're whatever you are. So there's millions of ways people do. We're desperate, so we'll look anywhere. Should not a people consult their gods, say the people, because it's desperate. Assyria's coming in the north, the siege of Jerusalem. The dead on behalf of the living, for teaching and for instruction. Surely those who speak like this will have no dawn, says Isaiah. Don't listen to the people who are terrifying you and you're reverting to pagan nonsense. A 21 to 9:1 is really an important one because it's quoted in the New Testament too, and I've retranslated it entirely from what you find in the Bible. Because when I was hundreds of years ago, when I was doing my course in Rome, there was a South American, I think he was Argentinian Jesuit, who took us through very short passages of Isaiah, and one of them was this passage, and he gave us, the lectures were in Italian, so anyhow, that's another matter. So he gave us an Italian rendition of this and went through the whole thing. It impressed me so much. So I then translated his Italian into English. And when I was in Rome this last time writing a commentary on Isaiah, I got in contact with him and said, could I use it? And what did he think of my translation? And I'll tell you the nice bit. He said, marvellous translation in English. It's exactly what he's trying to say, and thank you very much. And of course you can use it. Just, you know, and I think in my commentary I indicate, because it's not published or anything what he did. So, but I thought it helped remind me of how difficult it is to translate the poetry of Isaiah, because it's so powerful when you break it open and really work on one little passage really hard the way he did. With his Spanish-Italian. And yet the translation, when you read it in your Bible, in your New Testament or the Old Testament, is kind of a bit bland, accurate enough, but doesn't capture the feeling of it. So I want to give you the whole works. So here comes a description now of the aftermath of the Assyrian invasion of the north, 732. So 734 to 732 is the period we're talking about now. They don't listen. They call in Assyria to side with them, and they shouldn't have. Assyria now races through the northern kingdom and really destroys nearly all of it. I'll show you in a minute. And this describes it. It's a powerful poetic description of the situation in the northern Israel, the threat of which caused Assyria to try to force Judah to join in an anti-Assyrian alliance, which I've told you about. Assyria annexed Galilee. That's why we find it in the New Testament, because that's where Jesus is doing his preaching. And had control of the Esdraelon plain and the Mediterranean coastline. All that remained in Israel of Israel now was the northern kingdom of Samaria, the spine, the north mountain area. And there's a map. It's a modern map, but I've just, in a pretty ugly way, showed you what, when Assyria came through, it divided the northern kingdom into three provinces. One of them it called Megiddo, from the mountain of Megiddo. The mountain of Megiddo is there, and that's the rich Esdraelon, the east-west plain. Everything's north-south, except suddenly there are the mountains. Can you see a little darker? And there are mountains there of Galilee, but there's a plain there. And that was controlled by the fortress at Megiddo. So that part there, that whole area, Galilee really, was called Megiddo. Dor isn't marked on this map, but it's about there. And they called it Duru or Dor, and that was this area, going down to Egypt. And Galazu is Gilead, which is this side of the Jordan. So they conquered all of that and divided it into three little provinces and left just the area where Samaria is, that spine there of what we call Samaria. That's what happened in 732 BC. In 721, Samaria was captured too and the whole lot went. So let's look at the text. The bits in brackets are not in the Hebrew. They're just an explanation of the meaning of the Hebrew. He wanders across it, oppressed and hungry. Starving and desperate, he curses his king and his God as he turns his face upwards. Downward to the earth he looks. Nothing but anguish, darkness, swirling oppression, confused gloom. There is no glimmer of light for an oppressed land. The humiliation of the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, that's Galilee. Oppression in the way of the sea, Transjordan, and the Galilee of the nations. They're the three provinces. Assyria, I've just said it to you. So the way of the sea is Duru, all that part on the Mediterranean. Transjordan is Gilead, across the eastern side of the Jordan. And Galilee of the nations is Megiddo. In its original setting, this may have been a prophetic oracle from Isaiah on the occasion of the birth of Ahaz's son. Hezekiah. As noted earlier, the chronology of this period of Judah's history... Oh, I beg your pardon. That's the end of that. Now we're moving up to verses 2 to 7. So this is preparatory to this. I was just tricked by the fact that this has got no connection with the last section. It's not an explanation. It's a looking ahead. I've just lost my way a bit there. So, chapter 9 then, 2 to 7. So we've had a description of the terrible collapse of that part that Isaiah witnessed, of course. Now, verses 2 to 7 of chapter 9 may have been a prophetic oracle from Isaiah on the occasion of the birth of Hezekiah. As noted earlier, the chronology of this period of Judah's history is unclear. You find that in the introduction of the book. If Hezekiah's reign began in 714, he may have been born in 732, which puts him where we are talking about. This would fit with the sign given earlier, in which Emmanuel may have also been referring to Hezekiah. A maiden is with child could well have been talking about Ahaz's young wife, you know. When your child is born and gets to the age, it'll all be over, which is an attractive hypothesis at least. As the text stands, it's so general as to be able to be reapplied to evoke hope at the birth of other princes of the house of David. So, Ahaz, don't go with Assyria. Your wife's pregnant, the maiden is with child, and by the time she bears, she'll call Emmanuel. So hang in there. You've only got a few months, you'll see. And then very short, when he's a little boy, you'll already see the collapse of the north. So don't go there. That could have been what he was saying in its original setting. And then applied, of course, by Matthew to Mary and Joseph and Jesus in a different setting. Chapter 9, verse 2. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those dwelling in a land of deep darkness, light has dawned. And you'll find that in chapter 4, verse 16 of Matthew, at the beginning of Jesus' public ministry, precisely in the area that collapsed under the Sargon II in 732, in Galilee. So You can see why he's put it there, why they've quoted that text. Goes on, verse 3. You have enlarged the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoiced before you as with joy at the harvest, as people exult when dividing plunder. For the yoke of their burden and the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. Referring back to either the book of Numbers or the book of Judges, two big battles in the ancient legends when Midian was conquered in battle. For all the boots of the tramping warriors and all the garments rolled in blood shall be burnt as fuel for the fire. For a child is born for us, a son is given to us. So the birth of Hezekiah, suggestion only, as a reasonable hypothesis, allows Isaiah to speak with hope to the king about this child, about what will happen, and that it will reverse all the dreadful things that have just been happening. The child is born, a son is given, could be Hezekiah. It's the most attractive hypothesis for me, having studied it. And now you know this text from other places, from the Messiah, among other things, don't you? For there's the text over on the left side, and here's a little... For a child is born to us, a son is given. And you can see the why. People who love their scriptures, whatever Hezekiah did, look at this son, Jesus, and what he's done. So they use the poetry of that to apply it to Jesus. Authority rests upon his shoulders. He is named, and here are the names. Because when a prince is born, he gets his own name. But then when you ascend the throne, you get a throne name. That was what the Egyptians did. Everybody did it. So you get, and that was a symbol of the hopes that the people placed in you. So this young prince, when he becomes king, these will be the names that are going to be given to him. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Wonderful Counselor. He's going to be someone who shares in the power of Yahweh to work wonders, to establish plans that can lead the people to recognize Yahweh's way and to discover his will. Counselor. Mighty God. Filled, in other words, with the numinous power of God, El, against external enemies. They're not claiming he's divine, of course. He's not God, but the might of God is in him, and he is the instrument of God's might against the enemies of Judah. Everlasting Father. He's going to be divinely appointed protector of the fatherland, father of the people, the king. And everlasting meaning, what is it? The queen is dead, long live the queen, is that what we say? So everlasting meaning... forever and ever and ever. Prince of Peace, he will establish the land in security, prosperity and political stability because of the wholesome state of mind of the people based on their obedience to God's revealed will. A big way of telling you what peace means. His authority shall grow continually. There shall be endless peace for the throne of David and his kingdom. He will establish and uphold it with just decrees and righteousness from this time onward and forever. And you find that, if you look at Luke chapter 1, verse 32, you find that alluded to in the statements made there about the other son who is going to fulfill this in a way that Hezekiah could never do. The spirituality of the Old Testament, hopes placed in that king, are actually fulfilled in this king. Not that Isaiah foresaw Jesus, we're not saying that, but the language of that is taken to keep pointing to Jesus as the one who fulfills the hopes of Israel. The zeal of Yahweh of hosts will do this.